It is a pleasure to be here. It is a pleasure to be here, but quite frankly, it gives me no pleasure to give this talk. I started with a quote that I pulled from a preceding paper I wrote in 2007 for the Range Beef Cow Symposium, and that was actually my first talk for UNL, but I wasn't a UNL employee yet. I thought this might be the most offensive quote of the day, but Tom, you might have beat me with pointing out two breeds amongst all the others and torquing more people off. Not that I disagree, but at least I'm not the one that pissed most people off here this morning. But the reason I pulled this out is that I agree we've made great strides in genetics and we have more to do. But I talked about crossbreeding in 2007, which as a recent graduate, I never thought I'd talk about crossbreeding. I thought that was something we checked off the list and moved on. And here in 2013, we're talking about it again. And Tom, if we're going to make those great strides we need to make, we can't run around in circles. At some point, we've got to start running forward. And that's what concerns me, honestly, about this morning's session. So I wanted to start with this quote. It's one that I believe, and I think as we move forward, we need to consider this.
There we go. Super. Well, Matt, I agree. I think one of our real challenges is making progress. And in many ways, I couldn't agree more with Neville and Tom, your points on the value creation of cattle at the end of our value chain. Okay, clearly driving a lot of signal in the U.S. beef industry. The challenge is connecting the dots, right? I'm all for JBS making a profit. I think that we got to keep our packers profitable, but at the same time, we got to keep the average commercial cow-calf producer profitable. And the challenge in that is how calves are marketed and how you can capture value. I think, Tom, in many ways, your premise is right about we can generate lots of value in calves, but if you don't retain ownership on them, clear to harvest, put them across the grid or partner with a feed yard to do that, you don't have an effective way to capture that value. And so many of the comments I think that Matt and I are going to make are focused on addressing value capture and value creation for a majority of the cow-calf producers in our country that sell calves at weaning time. And I don't disagree that focusing on end product and product growth and development of our beef market share isn't important. But if we don't have cow-calf producers that are profitable selling conventionally in our marketing chain, for a number of years moving forward, we're going to continue to make the beef business smaller and smaller and smaller. And I don't think anybody in this room wants that. And I think one of the things that we wanted to do is remind us of what are the trade-offs. And I think, Neville, your comment about debate versus examination is a very good one. And one of the things that I was glad to have this on the program is to elevate the dialogue and really get to the crux of the issues so that producers can make informed decisions. So with that, Matt, what are some of the benefits, just as a quick way to remind us about what some of those potential trade-offs might be as we think about heterosis?
Yeah, so I think it's important, and I understand this audience understands what heterosis is, but so often you talk to people and the assumption is that I make some random cross, breed X, breed Y, and I come up with a superior animal. It doesn't really matter what breed X was, what breed Y was, nor where most people go wrong, which animal within breed X and which animal within breed Y I crossed. And that's not the case. Obviously, heterosis, a lot of us know it as hybrid vigor. The superiority of crossbred animals is compared to the average, as compared to the average of a straight-bred parent. So I put up there the more divergent the parental lines, the more heterosis. What I mean by parental lines here is breeds. The more divergent those breeds are, the more heterosis we get. So if we go with a more extreme example of Bos Taurus by Bos Indicus crosses, we get more heterosis. And this is not available from within breed matings. A few reminders, and you see the date at the bottom of that. This is something this audience has seen for a long time now in terms of the benefits, the biological benefits of heterosis. In the second column, I have the improvement of the trait and units of the trait. The third column, the amount of heterosis we get. And this is advantages of that crossbred calf. So taking purebred animals of two breeds and crossing them, we see an advantage in calving rate and survival. That's why we also call it hybrid vigor. Admittedly, and I think, Neville, you pointed out in your first draft of the white paper, and it probably still resides there, we do see an increase in birth weight from that. And we can see that advantages, of course, in weaning weight and in post-weaning growth as well. These are Bos Taurus by Bos Taurus examples here. But this shows you the advantages of the crossbred calf. The real advantage, though, Bob and I and others would argue, are the advantages of the crossbred cow. And here we see that, and Tom pointed out some of those examples as well in his talk in terms of longevity. And that longevity then leading into cow production over her lifetime in terms of cumulative weaning weight, and Tom put some economic numbers to that, and Bob did as well, and we're going to use the higher of the two for our purposes. But the fact is, the crossbred cow is where you can really derive an awful lot of value. And Bob put it together perhaps in an easier way to conceptualize here on the next slide. If we look at what ends up being on your far left, that bar there, that's the straight-bred cows producing straight-bred calves is the base. And then the middle bar there, we see producing crossbred calves but not taking advantage of the maternal heterosis. And we see obviously an improvement in weaning weight per cow exposed. But then if we add to it that maternal component, having that crossbred cow, Bob, contributes more than half of that advantage we see in the third bar there. So the point is we can't overstate the importance of not just having crossbred animals, but taking advantage of having crossbred females. I think the important question, though, to get to the meat of it, Bob, is really what does this mean in terms of economics? I've shown some biological improvements from heterosis, but economically, what's this mean to cow-calf producers?
Sure, Matt. The reality is that for commercial cow-calf producers, changes in reproduction have significant impact. And I like to focus our discussion not on just individual animal performance, but instead on a sort of more systems view about how that group of animals performs within a herd. I think all too often we base decisions in our business based more on individual animal performance and individual animal premiums without taking into account that's the realization of successes, right? But we know in cow herds we have reproductive failures. And so you've got to get your arm around the entire cow herd in an operation to get an idea about how that group of animals performs collectively that drives to the bottom line economic efficiency that I agree Darrell Peel pointed out very nicely to us recently. And it's economic efficiency that keeps business and sustains businesses over time. Okay, and so some nice work done in the mid-1990s at the initiation of some of the Strategic Alliance field study work looking at the value of different groups of traits in a vertically integrated business. So this would be a cow-calf producer that raises calves and owns them clear to harvest. And in that particular system, the reproductive traits were still twice as important as either the growth or the in-product carcass traits. Okay, and that's a system where it puts the most weight on in-product. If we look at a typical non-integrated system, these values are more in the order of 8 to 4 to 1, okay, out of that Melton work. So reproduction, if you sell calves at weaning time, is 8 times more important than in-product value and 4 times or twice as important as growth traits. Okay, so we've got to keep our eye on reproduction. I know there's lots of reproductive physiologists in the room, so I hope that this resonates, that reproduction drives revenue and profitability in cow-calf operations. Some work done, Dickerson, obviously a famous person looking at system efficiencies, suggested that in many of those situations, changing the number of progeny that are driven to market dramatically changes the production efficiency and ultimately the economic efficiency of those operations. Because you've got the same amount of fixed costs and from a cow herd standpoint, variable costs. Changing the number of progeny you actually get to market, whether that's weaning or clear to harvest, dramatically changes break-even cost of production. And so we can change that number of calves marketed most easily by changing reproductive rate. Okay, and that's where, as Matt pointed out, we have a huge impact from the heterosis side in the cow herd. I like to conceptualize things with examples. This is one I put together a number of years ago to look at the value and dollars generated through heterosis. 100-cow example, 80% weaning rate, 575-pound calves on average, 10-year time horizon. For those of us in this room that are seed stock producers, we know genetic change takes a long time, and realizing the benefits of that genetic change obviously takes a period of time as well. So I looked at that on a 10-year time frame. If we look at calf survival, the weaning literature estimates say about 6% improvement. Over that time period, that's 60 head of calves. That's most of a potload of calves, additional production. Weaning weight, I used half the literature value of 8% here. I'm kind of conservative. That's half a potload of calves. If we look at weaning weight per cow exposed, which is the preferred metric for evaluating production efficiency at cow-calf production, the low estimates for heterosis in a system that maximizes heterosis of the cow side and the calf side says about a 23% improvement in weaning weight per cow exposed. Mind you, the harsher the environment or the lower inputs in the environment, that number goes up. And if you go into situations where you include some Bos indicus, this number can approach 50%. Okay, but we're going to use a low number. That's 23%. That produces about 106,000 pounds of additional sale weight from the same set of cows, the same input costs. Okay, that's equivalent to 18 more 575-pound calves per year. Or if you do the math at $1.50 for 5-weight calves, which is pretty typical of current market, that's $150 per cow per year. Okay. $150 per cow per year. The key here is if you sell those calves at weaning time, you get to capture that. Okay? One of the real cruxes in our discussion is understanding, and I think this is the one that producers need to answer first when they think about, I got two breeding systems in front of me, straight breeding and crossbreeding. The thing you have to understand and quantify to make a good decision in this arena is, do the benefits of selection for economically important or convenience traits within breed via straight breeding outweigh the improvement of lowly heritable traits via heterosis, particularly on the cow side? Okay, that's the dollars and cents in trade-off. Okay, it's the dollars and cents in the trade-off. You have to answer that question. And one of the things that really I think is challenging to us is oftentimes we think, you know, selection for growth or in-product traits and heterosis are mutually exclusive events. And that couldn't be further from the truth. Okay? We can simultaneously, through appropriate breed and individual animal selection within breed, do a very nice job of capturing lots of additive genetic merit, and we use EPDs and selection index to grab, and build crossbred cows and crossbred calves, and drive them to a market endpoint, either at weaning time or clear to harvest. Okay? Tom, your point about structured systems, whether those are straight breeding systems or crossbreeding systems, couldn't be more right. Okay, the old adage, crap in, crap out, works in animal breeding too. Okay.
So, Bob, I think one of the concerns, and it does go towards the economic question of this, is the sacrificing of uniformity and, as a consequence, the marketability of calves produced from a crossbreeding system. And this really goes to that having a plan. And if we have a planned crossbreeding system, we can alleviate some of those concerns. So what are your thoughts on that?
I agree, Matt. One of the things that we have to understand when we think about variation generated through animal breeding is really, in the situation of crossbreeding, two sources of that variation. One is the genetic variation that we observe from the additive genetic action that we use EPDs to describe. And the other one is the variation in calf phenotype, whether that's in terms of weight or type and color, that's induced by the mating system. Okay, those are two different sources of variation that we have to manage when we think about crossbreeding systems. One of those sources of variation is described here. If you look at the very top, that's two sets of purebreds that have divergent mean or divergent average performance for a trait, let's say, weaning weight. Okay, you'll notice the variation or the width of those two bell curves is the same. Okay, if we look across breeds, variation in weaning weight's about the same within breed across lots of breeds. Okay, if we take those two breeds and put them in a two-breed rotational crossbreeding system, we generate the variation that's in the second plot. If we take and plot the animals out by breed of sire, we can create two humps just like this plot. That describes the variation of those. And within each of those sire groups, we have variation that's similar to either of the purebred parents. But we've induced more total variation in the system because of differences in breed composition from these divergently mated or divergent average parents. Okay? So unless you have a way to manage, i.e. sort up, progeny by sire group, when you go to a conventional marketing system and sell calves at weaning time, you're probably going to get beat up a little bit, okay? Because there's a big difference, especially if there's color and kind differences in those calves. The marketing system will not reward you for doing that, okay? But if you're a big enough producer, if you're a unit that, say, has 1,000 cows in each one of those humps, the breeding system's really easy. You get one kind of bull and turn out with all these cows. And you can market potloads of uniform calves by type and kind. That's manageable. If you're a small producer and do this, it's more challenging, admittedly. The bottom one represents, then, mating of hybrids, or F1s, or composites, of equal breed fractions. In this case, a two-breed F1s, intersay mated over time. Those populations don't generate any more variation than the parents, or the purebred parents that they were sampled from. And that's strictly a function of genetic sampling. Okay, and the proof of that is here. This is a summation of a large amount of work done at the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center, summarized by Gregory and others. And it evaluates the coefficients of variation for purebreds and composites for all these traits. And none of them are statistically different. Okay, that tells us that when we sample genetics from these two different breeds, or four different breeds, whatever went into the composites, once we've done that sampling, we don't have any more variation within trait than either of the parent breeds that we sampled from, okay? And I know that's a lot to get your head around quickly, but it's true, okay? So, Matt, one of the things that my clients that I work with a lot suggest that, you know, breeds have changed over time, and there's good evidence to support that. So does heterosis still exist? We've changed performance levels over time. And how about the issues of complementarity due to that change?
Thanks, Bob. That's a good question. And really, those are two different questions. And it's important to delineate the differences between heterosis and complementarity. Those are two extremely powerful tools that we have as cattle producers, and they're different tools. Here, what we have is genetic transfer weaning weight for several popular breeds. If your breed's not up there, those are actually the seven breeds that record the most calves in the U.S. If your breed's not up there, it's not with a malice of forethought. But what you see is a lot of change, particularly some breeds. I mean, the steepest line up there is the black one. That's Angus cattle. It made tremendous change in terms of weaning weight. And I'd remind you a comment that Bob made earlier. These changes that we see here, one, these are due to seed stock breeders utilizing the relevant EPDs to make change, and that's due to additive genetic effects, okay? That's what these genetic trends are for, and tremendous change made in these. And if we go to the next slide, Bob, we'll see the same thing for yearling weight as well. Tremendous change, and those breeds, in some cases, have almost begun to converge. Some have actually become a little bit more divergent in terms of these breed means over time for some of these traits, but we have seen some breed means converge, and I think that's represented extremely well on the next slide as we look at mature cow weight. The red bars, and again, this is data summarized from the Meat Animal Research Center, the red bars there represent cows born in the early 1970s as summarized from cycles 1 and 2 of the U.S. Mark Germplasm Evaluation Project. On the bottom, going left to right, Hereford Angus or Angus Hereford, females, Red Angus, Simmental, Gelby, Limousine, and Charlet. Two things to point out here, and the first one is obvious to everyone without even seeing this slide. Cows over the last 30 years have gotten bigger, okay? That's not a big shocker, right?
A lot bigger.
All the blue bars are taller than all the red bars. Right. The other thing to point out, though, the traditional paradigms we have in terms of the way we might categorize breeds no longer apply in a lot of cases. And we can see now those Hereford Angus Hereford cows who were the most conservative at their mature weight in the 1970s, born in the 1970s. We fast forward to females born in the late 90s, early 2000. Those now represent the largest mature weight females. So as we think about crossbreeding systems, we think about what complementarity is, we should not classify breeds the way they ranked three decades ago. We need to think about breeds the way they are today. And so realize that breed complementarity is pairing together breeds in a crossbreeding system, a well-planned crossbreeding system, such that we're able to blend strengths and weaknesses. And heterosis then becomes our reward for having done so. I think a perfect example of complementarity is actually on the next slide as we think about end product traits. Highly heritable carcass traits, and as a consequence, we would expect little, very little, heterotic effects. But that does not mean we can't still take advantage of breed complementarity here. And this is data from 2004, Cundiff and others. If we look at the top line there, traditional British breeds, Angus, Red Angus, Hereford, percent yield grades 1s and 2s, percent prime and choice Y4s standards. You can see traditional British breeds excelling in carcass quality as defined by marbling it or intermuscular fat. We look at the second line, traditional continental breeds, Simmental, Gelby, Limousin, Charlet. Where do they excel? Yield. And so the complementarity issue here is blending those advantages, quality and yield, together in a structured crossbreeding system, although we won't expect tremendous heterosis advantages for these carcass traits. We can still take advantages of the strengths represented in both breeds. And really, that's breed complementarity. So the critical point to understand is, in the cases where we have seen convergence of breed means, that may mean that complementarity has eroded. That does not mean that heterosis has eroded. Those are two separate issues, and that's important to understand. So Bob, as we begin to wrap up here, I'd like to know, how do I decide, how do they decide what breeding system is right for them?
It's a great question, Matt. I think one of the things to consider when we do this, obviously, is understand how you sell calves today and how you may plan to sell calves in the future, and certainly consideration of how product may work downstream for other participants in the value chain. And in that context, we have to understand that not all crossbreeding systems are equal, right? Some of them are more difficult to implement. Some of them are as easy to implement as straight breeding, okay? So we have to have some idea of both the different systems because they yield different rewards. Typically, the more intensive ones in many cases yield higher advantages in terms of percent calf crop wean per cow exposed, and certainly that's driven by increased retained heterosis induced by that system. So, you know, the classic three-breed rotation or F1 terminal sire system there generates somewhere between 20 and 24% more pounds of calf wean per cow exposed, lots of heterosis. Simpler systems to implement, F1 or hybrid bulls of either two breeds, three breeds, or four breeds involved in those systems are as simple as either a straight breeding program in the case of mating AB here, where we've got bulls and cows of the same breed compositions mated together, generates about half the amount of heterosis of the F1 terminal sire system, but it's easy to do as straight breeding, so you get to capture some optimization there. You can enhance that by using F1s of different breed types to mate together. So those systems are easy to do but don't yield as much advantage as some of the more complicated systems. So how do we decide? Well, aside from some of the other constraints, one of the things I want you to think about is, are you profit-minded or premium-minded? Okay? One of the things that is very, very challenging for commercial and seed stock producers oftentimes is to get a very good and clear picture of the economic situation of your farm or ranch. OK, okay? And that's something I encourage people to work on and start simple and work to understand the interactions of not just pay weight and the value of that pay weight, but also the costs and input side of our cow herd. Certainly, if anybody's been paying attention over the last few years, this won't be a revelation to you. Feed, fertilizer, and fuel costs are through the roof, okay? And many, many producers are thinking about how do I use less of all three of those in my production system to minimize input costs. The concern is how does that affect productivity and output? I mean, those things are connected, right? And one of the things that I argue is that as we think about making those changes, why not give our cows all the opportunities to be successful in those production systems by having heterosis and some complementarity to be successful? Okay, those environmental challenges are met better by cows of broader genetic background than a narrower background. So as we think about the first point there, are we profit-minded or premium-minded? Make sure we put both of those in the equation because it's important to understand the effect of that on net net revenue for an operation. The next one's herd size. Obviously, one of the biggest challenges for crossbreeding systems is how to effectively manage not only the breeding pastures and efficient use of bull power in those systems. So herd size plays a very key role in determining which system is appropriate. And Matt and I neither are naive enough to suggest that A, crossbreeding is appropriate for everybody, or B, that there's one crossbreeding system that fits every producer. Okay, there's lots of variables that need to be understood, and certainly herd size is one of those. You know, if you're a big ranch and you run 4,000 or 5,000 head of cows on 4 or 5 different units, managing a rotational crossbreeding system is really pretty easy. Okay, because you produce replacement heifers at one unit, and you move them to another unit where they're bred to the same kind of bull. The same kind of bulls get delivered every year to each of those units. It's pretty fall down easy. Okay. But if you have 200 head of cows and you're in a 3-breed rotational system on a single operation, you got to start identifying breeder sires for every cow. You got to make sure your breeding pastures are assorted. It complicates things. So size appropriateness is a very key consideration, and Matt and I will both concede that straight away. One of the other components is how do you generate replacement heifers? Okay, every cow-calf operation has got to have replacement heifers, right? Understanding if you're in an F1 terminal sire system, where do I buy replacement heifers that fit my specification because I know my breeding system isn't going to generate any, okay? An obvious constraint. How do you market calves? I really appreciate, again, Neville and Tom's focus on the value we need to create at the far end of our production chain, okay? But if you don't have a way to capture that, we've got to make sure we understand the trade-offs we make to different endpoints based on using either straight breeding or crossbreeding systems. Other constraints include environment. Certainly, there's some environments that we produce calves in the United States where a little bit of Bos indicus influence is really, really valuable. Okay, there's other places where that's less important. Okay, so environment plays a very important role as we think about complementarity traits and heterosis as well. And then finally, management. Okay, one of the most important components for success in either a straight breeding system or a crossbreeding system is managerial skill. Okay, getting a plan and sticking to it is essential for success in any of those systems, and making sure that you understand not only how you sell calves, but your ability to actually manage the breeding system and manage the selection of animals from within one breed or multiple breeds is essential to success. So, Matt, I think we both are of the opinion that in many cases crossbreeding has some additional work to it, not always, but often. But we think in the long run that effort's worth it. Okay? Matt, do you have anything to close?
No, the simplicity that can be garnered now from the large selection we have in our composite animals, the Limflex, the Balancers, the Sim Angus, has certainly alleviated some of the logistical hurdles that existed earlier on relative to developing crossbreeding systems. So in my mind, in a lot of cases, it's become even easier than it once was.
think you're right on that front, Matt. And it's pretty easy to take and make relatively high percentage, say, Angus calves, even from crossbred calves. So we've got lots of flexibility now that a number of years ago we didn't have. So with that, I think we're actually pretty close on time. Success is had. We appreciate y'all's attention. Look forward to a broader examination with the panel. Guys, I think that's maybe our next step. Megan, thanks again for the invitation. We appreciate being here.